This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Simon Wathrow is the president of Reptiles Victoria and the author of Living with Snakes and Other Reptiles. Hi, Simon.
Good morning, Trevor. How's it going?
Well, thank you. We don't have rattlesnakes here, but what's our most common snake in Australia?
I guess if you're going to say the most common snake that people see would be probably the group of brown snakes we call Sydneya. Is a very common species of venomous snake that's seen all over the roads and in rural areas.
So are most of our snakes venomous, or is it that we just see them more or something?
I think the venomous snakes definitely have adapted to man-made changes a lot better and more successful. So they're definitely more common. But I think there is a very big group of venomous snake family, which makes them more likely to be seen, and they're definitely more pronounced in everybody's mind.
So it's this the time of year, I suppose, in the southern states that we start to see snakes coming out and are becoming more active?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely spring heading into October. The males have come out, shed their skin. They basically eat something and then they start looking for females. So spring is a really big movement of snakes where you'll see them all along the roads. Sometimes they get hit by cars. People will talk about them crossing roads, appearing in backyards. So, yeah, there's a big movement at the moment.
When you say, because your book is called Living with Snakes and Other Reptiles, I mean, that's the issue, isn't it? Is that the snakes are going to be around and we need to learn how to live with them and cohabitate with them.
It would definitely be very helpful. It will reduce stress and panic, and people just find the way to just kind of cohabit with them, understand them and not be so scared. It would be quite useful.
Is that one of the things, though, is that we have a fear of snakes, and that snake, that fear is almost, it's not instinctive, but it's almost a learned behaviour that we have to be scared of snakes?
It is very interesting. It is definitely a learned behaviour. It's definitely a behaviour that in the last sort of 100 years of the Australian public has been almost terrified, whether it's through media or the snake charmers or something's happened where they've really built up this fear. You know, the top 10 deadliest snakes live here, which is not true, but the persona is there. You know, we had the most deadliest snakes, and one drop of venom will kill 100,000 people or whatever the story is. There's just so many stories, and people grow up with that fear, and that really personifies it. When you see a snake, the reaction on someone's face is quite dramatic.
So, I mean, realistically, if you take a look at the number of people that are bitten every year by snakes in Australia and compare that with the number of people that actually die of snake bite in Australia, is it really very high?
No, it's actually really, really low. We have a few things. We have a fairly good education about snakes. We have a fantastic hospital emergency system where we have anti-venom, the best anti-venom in the world. We have a really good level of care for people that, if they are bitten, they've got great care. It's free, which is really important. Whereas you look at somewhere like India, might have 30 to 40,000 people die. Sri Lanka, 20,000. All these really, really high in other cultures around the world.
Are you serious? Did that many people die in India and Sri Lanka from snake bites?
Yeah, they don't have great first aid, so you know, they've still got 1 billion people in India, so it's kind of not half unexpected, but they have a very poor health system in rural areas. So when they get bitten, they don't receive anti-venom. They have a high, what we call, morbidity. And that means that people that don't die will have such damage to their limbs, like an arm might have to be amputated, or it's completely paralysed, or the muscle's been eaten away by the venom's secondary effects. Whereas in Australia, we don't have a high morbidity. You generally get a life-threatening situation if it's a really bad bite, and then you recover, and often that's just it.
You know how you'll always hear stories about, if you get bitten by a death adder, or if you get bitten by a red-bellied black snake or a brown snake, you've got a minute to live.
Yeah, it's one of the legends, you know, that Australians always like to build up a good snake story. That's one of the things I've really learned in my time as a snake catcher, is that, you know, we love a good snake tale. It makes life interesting. Snakes generally just don't live up to the hype. You know, when you're a snake catcher, you know, they put on a bit of a show sometimes when you corner them and do those sort of things, but they generally are very shy and very retiring. And you get these stories about, you know, you get bitten and you've got, you know, 5 minutes to live or something. But there's one snake that has a truly hard-hitting, and he's genuinely a hard-hitting snake, and that's the taipan, which people don't generally come across. So he's very big, and he knows how to deal with people if they sort of come across him. But to get bitten by a taipan is truly not a good experience.
You'd have to go out of your way to do it.
You do. You really do. They're such good eyesight, such smart thinking snake that they really know how to avoid people so well. It's extremely rare, and you have to be very unlucky to be bitten by one.
Is that one of the other things, is that snakes try to avoid us and don't particularly like being around us? So the chances of being bitten by a snake is greater if we decide to interact with them.
It really is. So snake catchers all have an exceptionally high chance of being bitten because they're deliberately interfering with snakes, removing them from people's backyards. So inevitably, they have something like between 70 and 90% chance of being bitten, whereas the average person probably has a 0.05% chance. So, yeah, interfering with snakes, the classic 70s and sort of early 80s with the drinking alcohol increased the chance in a male between 18 and 40 because they always got bitten fooling around with snakes when they've been drinking at the pub or whatever.
That's just males between 18 and 40 just doing stupid things.
Well, they do a lot of things to get them injured, but that's part of the makeup, I suppose. But
if so, go on.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to say that. So it's definitely a high chance of being bitten if you are interfering with snakes. But if you don't, it's definitely very reduced.
Hello, Rosemary.
I'd like to know about carpet snakes, which have a lot around the house, and they seem to be active all through the winter. Now, do they hibernate?
Ah, Simon?
If you're in northern Australia and you've got a carpet python living in the roof, for example, they use a roof surface to keep that sort of body temperature going, so the sun keeps reflecting off the iron roof. In the wild, the carpet pythons tend to still be active in the sense that they might be coming out early evening, basking a little bit in the warmth of the road. But their activity is quite reduced. In northern Australia, the temperatures are still quite high, but the overnights drop, so they reduce their activity to match it.
So in northern Australia, do snakes hibernate?
Not in the true sense. You know, the classic thing with northern Australian reptiles, there is a big reduction in activity during the dry season. And then, obviously, as the rains come, they increase their activity for breeding. So it matches, you know, just like the winter and summer cycles of the southern states. But it's really, because it's so warm during the day, you still see snakes out and about in the dry season. But they're definitely less pronounced.
So one of the things on another occasion I spoke about snakes a while ago, we're talking about animals that venomate, and I was amazed to know that snakes don't necessarily inject venom every time they bite. They will dry bite. Can you just explain that to our listeners?
Okay, so one of the things about snakes is there's pretty much two types of bites. So pretty much imagine if, as a person, you're walking along and someone bumps into you or pinches the back of your neck. There's sort of the initial surprise. And in snakes, when you're walking through the bush, and let's say there's a tiger snake on the footpath and you don't see it and you step on it, the tiger snake's asleep on the footpath for some reason. It's basking, fell asleep. You step on it, it rears up and bites as a reflex, just the same way sometimes we throw our arm out if someone pinches the back of your neck. It's an instinct. A reaction that's just pure instinct. So they actually don't get a chance to squeeze venom into the fang to have it ready for biting. So when you confront a snake and the snake sees you coming, you have a stick in your hand and you go to whack it, it basically sees that an event's about to happen. It can't go anywhere. It's trapped in a room or what, you know, it's outside, cornered in the grass. It basically uses a muscle that squeezes its venom gland and puts the venom into the fang. It doesn't know that it's going to affect us, but just a natural instinct. So therefore, when you have attacking bites, such as you corner them, a dog biting them, something's happening, they've had time to prepare, they definitely will inject venom. Hence, we call them dry bites when members of the public are walking through the bush or you come around the corner and you accidentally step on a brown snake and it rears up and bites the leg. It's always dry, well, traditionally. The only thing that goes against that is if they bite you a second or third time, by then they've had a chance to push the venom into the fangs and bite properly.
So, but don't depend on that, I guess?
No, so we always treat all bites as being potentially dangerous, so they're always going to be, you know, you apply first aid bandage and all that, but as a rule, when they're surprised, snakes don't inject venom. And often, you know, when they bite first, they often quickly take off into the bush, and people say, I've just been bitten by a snake. And when you hear the talking and they say, I was bushwalking and I stood on it, almost a large proportion of that, you know they're safe. You know, even if you hear the story, you're like, yeah, they won't need anti-venom. It's always the same. When there's a confrontation and the snake has turned around and it's hissing and carrying on, looking at you, and you're still trying to get it or trying to catch it, or you know it's going to be a venomous bite. So they're the big differences between the two.
Really, when you see a snake, Simon, run away?
I think just be cool and just kind of give it the room to manoeuvre. That's probably the good excuse for it. You won't have a problem like that.
So stay still. Is that the best thing to do, is just to stay still?
I think there's a sort of a shocking component where no matter what I say, a plan of action, there's always the sudden surprise. Even as a snake catcher, or if we go on field trips, which we do over Australia, and we come across, you know, let's say a mulga snake, and there's this first instant of surprise, like, oh my God, there's a snake. It's like, oh, whoa, you know? And that instant, you always generally do stop still, and you're looking, and there's a few seconds, and the snake sees you, and looks at you, and you both, if you're standing still, the snake goes, okay, the threat's not coming to me, I've got a bit of room, so it knows what it wants to do. The worst thing is that sometimes the hole of a log is sort of to the side near where you are. And so when the snake goes, starts heading away, it's trying to get to the log, it might be behind you. And so it goes, and people say, it's coming towards you, and it's a panic. But if you stay still, they'll just go past you. Go to the log and go down the hole or whatever it is. If the hole is further in front of you somewhere, it'll just turn around and go into the hole. And, you know, your confrontation diverted.
I'll go back to calls in just 1 second, just before I do. Are there some snakes that are aggressive that will have a go at you?
I think that's a very interesting thing. Aggressive is a word I always apply to, let's think about dog breeds, where you have some dogs that if you really tick them off, they're going to go and explode into a fury of action. So once they get into that state, you know, pit bulls are a great example where, you know, we all talk about pit bulls being an aggressive breed. Hmm. And they can be. They're a powerhouse of action, and they really are damaging once they get into that state and attack a person. Snakes generally don't have that. They have a very strong defense. So once you provoke things like taipans, they're big, they're fast, they've got great eyesight, big fangs, they're really scary, and they can outmaneuver you in a very short distance, you know, between 1 and 5 meters. So that's definitely, if you put a taipan in a position where you're going to have a conflict, they are very fast and very quick to take people on, and they're very scary. And that's when people panic, they suddenly realise they've taken on too much. Brown snakes are similar. They've got a very big threat display, and they're fast, and they do this open mouth dance, which is famous. But the true aggression where you expect them to plan an attack is not true.
So,
no, they're not very aggressive.
So they're very good at being defensive.
They are. They have a very good defense, which is the last thing they need. So generally speaking, things like a dog, you know, might have a blue heeler rushing up, grabbing a snake. They try that, you know, getting away. But if they get confronted and the dog bails them up, they go straight into very strong defense. And brown snakes will sit up, open their mouth, show the venom. They squish the venom to their fang. They do the S shape. And then they just start striking as soon as the dog's right on them. So they go bang, bang, bang. You know, usually the dog will kill the snake as well, but they both end up getting in trouble.
We've got a board full of calls, so we'll go through calls
go
now. Stephen, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Trevor. We're in an area where we get anything up to 2 snakes a day easy. I firmly believe that especially the tiger snake, has got very good eyesight. It's just like a chook. It doesn't have any brain power to process it. I've seen them sitting watching a piece of polypipe cross the road, and he'll be absolutely concentrated on it, thinking it's obviously another big snake. And that's why, they're quite deadly when you've got a watch. They'll just sit there, you know. And so we get the Dugites and the Western Browns, but they'll buzz off when they see you. They won't hang around.
Steve, thank you. One of the things that Steve brings up there is that you see an awful lot of snakes, and people will say they have a lot of snakes around their property, and there are different ways they say make sure you don't have a lot of grass, high grass next to your house. What are the ways, Simon, to make your property as snake proof as possible as far as coming near your house?
Yeah, it's such a challenge. So in summer or during the wet season, you talk about keeping your house safe from both fire. You know, if you're living in rural areas, you've got fire, potential bushfires, and you've got snakes. They kind of go hand in hand sometimes. So getting the grass really short, getting rid of all the fallen rubble, people who have sheets of tin all around the back property. If you've got rural properties and you've got old sheds falling apart and all the sheets of tin come down, sheets of tin, when reptile people go on field trips and we find a sheet of tin in the wild, we know we're going to find a snake under it. That's just an awesome snake-attracting device. You've got your big one is for things like dugites, to some extent, tiger snake, is having lots of mice. So when you've got field mice hanging around the house, especially inside the kitchen, they come in after that through the bottom of the house. So you really want to get the rodent control situation in spring, kill the mice straight away inside the house, around the property. Being safe, obviously, not leaving bait out so the dog can eat it and that, but you definitely want to get on top of the mice and the rats. Things like brown snakes will also, they come through for shelter during the very height of summer. And so when there's a shaded area, like old sheds and things like that, they'll go in there for that reason, just to get them cooling off period.
Is it a good idea that if you have property, you could almost make a snaky area away from the house so that if the snakes will get more attracted to over there than it will be near your house?
Essentially, on rural properties, that's what you have. So you've got the house being surrounded by garden, but you generally find the snakes are just going from one side of the paddock across to the other. But okay. If the garden is overgrown, full of mice, they kind of hang in and go, hey, it's pretty cool here. You know, there's someone keeps putting the sprinkler on every afternoon, and they love that. So when the garden gets this massive watering every, 5 o'clock every afternoon, the snakes learn, hey, that's pretty cool. We can go there, get some moisture, chase a frog or two, get a mouse on the way out, and then, it's quite a good stopover. It's like going to an oasis in the middle of the,
So get rid of the stopover.
Yeah, you do have to, which is kind of hard when you've got a beautiful garden and, your family take pride in growing vegetables and things like that. It's hard to not provide the stopover.
Owen, good morning.
Yes, good morning to Ted and your guest. My question is actually a bit of a follow on you were talking just now about snakes and mice. I was wondering, what do snakes generally tend to eat? Because I thought it was usually like mice, because I've heard of them eating other things like guinea pigs and all that. And in fact, there's even been a few examples recently of snakes using livestock, and in fact, I was trying to look for the picture in Google that it seems to have gone. There's a case a few years ago in Malaysia. There's a picture of a snake which swallowed a ewe, which just sitting there looking like it had bitten off more than it could chew, and rescuers actually had to go and lure the snake or something like that.
What do they eat, Simon?
Yeah, it's really amazing. So one of the studies we've done with the Reptile Victoria Group, if we study the diets of a lot of the Victorian snakes, and it's fairly consistent. So most baby snakes, for example, generally need small skinks. So garden skinks are very popular for a beginning snake to basically grow into getting into bigger food items. So when you consider, let's use the example of brown snakes. So there's brown snakes all over Australia except Tasmania. And they start off eating skinks. So they're a little snake, they're only, 15 centimetres long, yeah. And they basically get hold of a skink. They eat one of those every few weeks. And they grow. And as they get bigger, they eat bigger skinks. And then as they get bigger, they learn to get into mice. And once they get into mice, it really is like a powerhouse food. They start growing really big. Brown snakes might eventually start taking on small rats and small rabbits and big blue tongue, for example. They might even eat one of those. So they get to a size they can really start to eat. Snakes will also eat other snakes. So brown snakes love eating other snakes. Mulga snakes, absolutely the best snake eater. Black-headed python, same thing. They love eating reptiles. They specialize in reptiles. So the mammals are an extra component. So the house mouse was introduced to Australia, which made certain snake populations explode in numbers. And the other, say, for example, a copperhead, it very much doesn't eat mice, but he loves his skinks and he loves snakes and he loves frogs. Same with tiger snakes. Tiger snakes will eat skinks, frogs, mice, rats, baby rabbits, and Tasmania is a big one. They eat a lot of baby rabbits in Tassie. But they also climb little bushes and start gobbling up baby birds. So they're a natural control of pest birds like Indian miners, noisy miners, starlings, and all those sort of things. They get in there and eat the baby birds. They love baby birds. And then you've got the black-headed python, like I said, is a snake eater, is also eats dragons, eats small goannas. Then you get up to the scrub python up North Queensland. The Queenslanders will know in the North Queensland areas, from Townsville up through to Cairns and Port Douglas, they get quite big and they'll eat small wallabies. So they progress from eating skinks into rodents, bandicoots, and they get to a size where they can take on a small wallaby. And famous photos around where they've eaten a wallaby and they have to wait, you know, about a week and a half, 2 weeks for the food to go through their system.
Jan, good morning.
Oh, hi. I've got a couple of questions. If you have lizards, do they detract from having snakes?
Okay, that's a great question. It's a really, really popular one. So the original question used to be, if you have a blue tongue, it'll keep snakes away. And a lot of that comes from the fact that, well, I think that people used to panic when they see a blue tongue and want to sort of move it away, and it's a very common backyard in urban, you know, Melbourne, Sydney, Tasmania. People ring up and say, oh, my God, it's a blue tongue. It's terrifying us all. Someone's got to come and take it away. So you say, well, look, having a blue tongue kind of occupies a spot where a snake might try and use it. So they're handy to have around. Having said that, things like big brown snake, big copperhead and mulga snakes will actually eat the blue tongue. So you better be a very big blue tongue to make sure a snake can't eat you. But if you're a small juvenile, the snakes do eat them up. So I kind of say yes and no. They do hang in spots where they block the snake from going under, say, a retaining wall. If a snake comes in, sticks its head in there, there's a blue tongue in there, they go, oh, okay, that's already occupied. And they'll move on. If it's not occupied, they could go in and shelter in there for a short time. But definitely blue tongues help. If you've got goannas, they definitely will eat snakes. So if you've got a lace monitor walking around in northern Australia, you've got what we call the yellow-spotted monitor, which is a very big goanna. He loves to eat snakes, so he'll go around and scratch them out and dig them up and eat them. So that's handy. So that would be the opposite problem that snakes have, is they've got a big goanna foraging around. They won't be happy to stay.
Jan, if you've got another question, make it very quick.
Also, I've got a red-bellied black snake went into my stable about 5 months ago. How dangerous is that?
So like any situation with a snake in a structure, there's a couple of good things about red-bellied black snakes, that their venom is not as life-threatening as, say, an eastern brown snake. They have a great threat display, noisy, and they put on a big show, so you know they're there, whereas brown snakes are a bit quieter and move so fast and suddenly that, you know, any situation in a stable, for example, can be a danger because brown snakes, if they get cornered, will actually turn around and sit up. Red-bellied blacks just, you know, make loud hissing noises and thrash themselves around. They make this big show, and it's really a good performance.
Beautiful looking snakes, though.
Good one. It's very polite, you know. They really make this big thing. Hey, watch out, I'm here, I'm here. And then they put up signs or send you an email, SMS your phone. There's plenty of warning. So it's really, really good stuff. But I think you'll find the red-bellied blacks going in either because there's mice in there or it's so hot outside, he's gone in to cool off. Sometimes the water, where the trough is a nice place to cool off for a snake, and they'll use that quite well. But generally, the horses are the worries that they stomp around, and the snakes sometimes get a fright inside the stable.
I've got a text here that has asked the question, is it true that if you have red-belly black snakes near your home, it'll keep brown snakes away?
They kind of keep each other under control. So if you've got a big red belly, you better have a monster brown snake, better be very confident to come on the property, because the red belly is definitely going to zone in on any small brown snakes. It's definitely the better of the two to have. Red bellies take a lot to make bite, so even if you go near them, step on them, do any of that sort of stuff, they're much more forgiving. And I definitely would rather have a red belly around. I'd encourage people, things like copperheads are the same, having copperheads around. I call them the Labradors of snakes. They're so gentle, they absolutely take huge amounts of harassing to make them bite. They're just a sweet snake, but they gobble up other snakes like a Pac-Man machine, so they're really handy.
Can I just say, though, Simon, you're a snake expert, and please don't go around stomping on or stirring up snakes and consider them to be a Labrador.
Very good advice.
Good morning, Peter.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Yes, my question is regarding... I know there are certain animals like the mongoose and meerkat and even goannas that are pretty much sort of resistant to snake venom. Can you explain the reason for this or the scientific reasons behind this?
Yeah, I don't know enough. Say, for example, the mongoose. If you've ever dealt with Indian caribous, they're not the smartest snake out of the cobra family. They're very predictable, so they orientate on whatever moves first. So with a mongoose, kind of tricks them into focusing on a certain area, and then they just dart around and grab it from behind the neck. I don't know if they're actually how resistant they are to venom. I just know they're actually very good at outsmarting the Indian cobra, so in a combat between the two, they usually win.
What about the goannas that live off snakes?
Well, the goannas... again, I don't think they're resistant. I think the venom affects them differently. So for the body mass and the scales that they have, when a snake bites, it doesn't affect them as much. So I don't think the word is immunity. I think the same thing when other snakes bite each other and they swallow each other whole. And sometimes with copperhead, for example, you might get a copperhead eating another copperhead. And if you're in the field and you see it, you can actually go up and basically pick up the one that's doing all the eating, and it'll regurgitate the other one, and the other one will just go, thank you, mate, and take off. He hasn't been envenomated, so to speak. But he's not immune. I think the idea is that the snake hasn't even bothered to use its venom. It's just started eating it live and it's going to swallow it live.
Go back to calls. Liz, good morning.
Oh, hi. I have a question. Sorry, it's echo again. I have two quick questions.
No, just one, Liz, because I've got lots of people.
Oh, okay. Well, the most important one it would be if you do have a dry bite, how does the doctor know that it's not an envenomated bite?
Great question.
That's really, really good. One of the biggest rules we have is, in Australia in particular, is that you treat everything as a snake bite. And this is one of the things that some people get embarrassed by. They're walking in the bush, for example, and especially everybody who knows blackberry bushes or sharp tussock grasses, and you feel this thing prick your limb and you see a little trickle of blood. And people, they go, oh, my God, I've been bitten by a snake. They haven't seen it, but they feel the pinpricks. Same as a snake bite. If you're walking through and you see a snake and it bites your calf or you got bitten on the hand while you're gardening, and you see a snake move off, you treat it as a snake bite. You treat it as a snake bite, you treat it as a venomous snake bite. Even if you think, oh, we get tree snakes up here, or we get keelbacks, or we get some sort of harmless snake, doesn't matter. It's a snake, it bit you, you bandage up your limb straight away, you stay put, and you call 000. So they're the key things in Australia, is just put the bandage on, 000, that's it, and you sit down. You don't go in the house, don't drive yourself to hospital. So we treat dry bites, venomous bites, makes no difference. It's all the same thing. The only way you're going to know is when you come out of hospital and they say you had a dry bite. That's when you go, oh, okay, I had a dry bite.
And is the idea of keeping calm really important, even though you might be feeling a bit panicky because you just got bitten by something? Is it important to try and keep as calm and not move as much as you possibly can?
It is, and it's so hard to do. I train snake people all over Australia in terms of how to catch snakes for a living, or in the mines of Australia, rangers, local laws. And I sit there in a classroom talking about what the snake bite plan is going to be for any of these guys, because they're all in the high risk category. They all nod their heads, you know. They're all like, yeah, we'll do that. We'll ring 000, we'll do this, and we'll have a plan, and we'll have our bandages on hand. And you think you've got a winner, like these guys will know what to do. And some of them will ring me up. They've been bitten and they'll be all over the place. It's the shock and panic comes after shock. You get a shock of any sort and then you start to feel dread or panic. People around you panic. It makes you panic. It's easy to say stay calm, but it's very hard to do in real life. So if you can, absolutely, I think of three things. First thing is that Australia has the best emergency system in the world. We have the second thing is the best anti-venom. And the third thing is that the majority of snake bites are dry. So with all those factors in your head, your chance of dying is very hard. You have to work exceptionally hard to die from snake bite. It can be very unlucky, but usually if 3,000 people get bitten, 300 might need anti-venom and 3 people might die.
Does that mean that it's really important that the people who are around the person that's been bitten don't get panicky, don't do all of that sort of stuff, because it's going to be their job to keep the person who's been bitten calm and reassure them?
It is, yeah. It's really one of those great things where they're really successful. Good story outcomes that you get is where people have applied the bandage and they say, okay, we're just going to call 000 and then we'll go to the hospital. And, you know, they just reassure them and keep that panic situation down. Unfortunately, it tends to be more the guy. It's very hard for men to stay still, especially that sort of, 18 to 40 again. We love to get up. We like to fix things. We like to, she'll be right, mate. I'll sort myself out. I'll drive to the hospital or... I don't think it bit me good enough. You know, I think I can't see any venom, or I don't think there's always this stuff, but it's always the same. Be calm, apply the bandage, call 000 and just wait.
And if you're one of the person that's helping to go, what am I going to do?
It's definitely the way to go. Put on a show.
Mary joins us. Good morning, Mary.
Hello, how are you?
Good, Mary.
That's good. I'll try and be quick because I know you're on a time limit. I've been living in Western Queensland for 30 years and I was terrified of snakes when I first came here. Mm. And I had 6 in 5 days, which really put the wind up me. But I developed a bit more of an interest in snakes rather than a phobia. So over the years, I've identified snakes as I've come across them. And I have had a lot of snakes in that time. So first of all, I used to have eastern brown snakes, and then the mulga browns took over from that time. Probably that lasted ages, about 15, 20 years.
Okay.
And just the last couple of years, I've got carpet snakes, and the mulga browns have disappeared.
So does that change? Do the populations change, Simon?
It can. There are certain changes in the environment. For example, browns adapt more when there's mice, lots of long grass. Mulgas will come a bit more when there's a... mulgas are a bit funny. They're a snake that pop up into the population. They're not... I don't know what the right word for them is, but they're definitely a snake that is the more natural the habitat is, the better they do. But they adapt quite readily. They get hit pretty hard by things like cane toads. And so in Queensland, you might see them disappear for a while because the cane toads come in, because they'll eat them. Obviously, that kills them. Whereas the brown snake does pretty well because it doesn't really eat cane toads, so it doesn't eat frogs. So it does eat frogs occasionally, but nowhere near as readily as the mulga snake. So that's why populations crash and boom, depending on the food source around them, and especially the landscape. So when there's a lot more grazing going on. Mulgus don't do so well in some grazing areas. Simon, some rounds kick in.
Our news is coming up. Would you mind joining us again on another occasion? We've still got a board full of calls here, so we might get you back in about a month or so, if you don't mind getting up early in the morning again.
Yeah, that's fine. I'd love to talk to everybody. That'd be brilliant.
Thank you very much for joining us.